I hold the pages flat against my dress, inside my coat, hoping they'll be legible when dry. The walk home is slow and painful. When I step into the house, I open my coat to find the bodice of my chambray dress tattooed with ink, a permanent reminder of how important his words have become to me. Summer again. When I answer the door one June morning in 1915 to find Walton standing there, he gives me a huge smile and presents me with a package of butterscotch candies. "Sweets for the sweet," he says. "That's an old line," I tell him. "You've said it before." He laughs.
I obviously have a limited repertoire.
Soon we fall back into our familiar routines, seeing each other nearly every day. We stroll the property, sail in the afternoon, picnic in early evening with the Carls and my brothers Al and Sam down by the grove. I see Ramona watching as Walton and I go off together to collect driftwood and twigs to make a fire in the circle of rocks, as he pulls me behind a tree and kisses me. At the end of the evening, we sit on the rough benches Papa made and watch the cinders crumble and settle. The sky changes from blue to purple to rose to red as the sun sinks like an ember into the sea. When Walton gets up to talk to Alva on the other side of the fire pit, Ramona comes to sit beside me. "I need to ask," she says quietly. "Has Walton discussed the nature of his commitment to you?" I knew this question was coming. I've been dreading it. "Not exactly," I tell her. "I think our commitment is understood."
"Understood by whom?"
"By both of us."
"Does he say anything?"
"Well, he needs to establish himself before—"
"I am prying. Forgive me. I've tried to keep my mouth shut." "But my goodness, this is the third year."
It's not like she's articulating anything I haven't thought myself, but her words feel like a punch in the gut. Walton is a scholar, I want to say, studying the classics and philosophy. He cannot make any decisions until he is done with school. Nobody seems to understand this.
I'm not sure I understand it myself.
"It's really not your business, Ramona," I say stiffly.
"It's not. You're right."
We sit in silence, the air between us bristling with words unsaid. After a few moments, she sighs.
"Look, Christina, be careful. That's all I'm saying.
I know Ramona means well, but this is like telling a person who has leapt off a cliff to be careful. I am already in mid-air." In late August, Walton and I make a plan to sail alone to Thomaston. Since my conversation with Ramona, I've been acutely aware of how deftly he evades any talk of commitment. Maybe she's right. I need to raise the issue directly. I resolve to do it on our sail. It's early evening, and the air is laced with cool. He stands behind me, unfurling a big wool blanket and wrapping it around our shoulders as I steer.
"Walton,"
I begin nervously.
"Christina?"
"I don't want you to leave."
"I don't want to leave,"
he says, wrapping his hand over mine. I slide my hand out from under his. "But you have things to look forward to. All I have is months of winter and waiting."
"Ah, my poor Persephone," he murmurs, kissing my hair, my shoulder.
This irritates me further. I pull away a bit. For a few moments we are quiet. I listen to the mournful yawp of seagulls overhead, as large as geese.
"I want to ask you something,"
I say finally.
"Ask?"
"Or, well, tell you."
"Go ahead."
"I love—"
I start, but my courage fades.
"Being with you."
He pulls the blanket tighter around me, enveloping us in a cocoon.
"I love being with you."
"But what are we? What are you?"
His hands move up my sides, resting on my ribs. I arch my back, leaning into him. And his hands move to the front, cupping my breasts gently through the fabric.
Oh, Christina, he breathes. Some things don't need explanation, do they?
I decide I will not ask him. Press him, insist. I tell myself it's not the time. But the fact is, I am afraid. Afraid that I will push him away. And that this, whatever it is, will end.
Al and I are clearing the dishes from supper one evening when he says,
So, what do you think is going to happen?
What? He's bent over the plates, scraping leftover potatoes and yams and applesauce into a bucket for the pigs.
You think Walton Hall is going to marry you?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it. But Al must know this is a lie.
All I'm saying is...
He is strained and awkward, unaccustomed to the intimacy of speaking his mind. All I'm saying is... I mock him impatiently. Stop hemming and hawing. Spit it out.
I've never seen you like this.
Like what?
As if reason has left you.
Honestly. Feeling a flare of annoyance, I handle the pots recklessly, clanging them into each other.
I'm concerned for you, he says.
Well, don't be. For a few minutes we work silently, clearing the table, scooping the cutlery into a bowl, pouring warm water from the kettle into a pan for the dishes. As I go through the familiar motions, I get even angrier. How dare he, this cautious man-child who has never been in love, pass judgment on Walton's motives and my own good sense? Al knows as much about the nature of our relationship as he does about sewing a dress. What do you think? I blurt finally. That I'm an imbecile? That I have not a thought in my head?
It's not you I worry about.
Well, you needn't worry. I can take care of myself. And besides, as if it's any of your business, Walton has been honorable in every way. Al lowers a stack of plates into the washing pan.
Of course he has. He likes the diversion. He doesn't want to give it up.
Clutching a fistful of forks, I turn to him. For a brief moment, I contemplate striking him with them. But instead, I take a deep breath and say, How dare you?
Come on, Christy. I don't mean to...
Again, his voice falters. And I can see, given how unnatural it must feel for him to confront me, how important he considers this. And yet I find him irritatingly simplistic. All the things I ordinarily admire about Al now strike me as deficits. His loyalty, no more than fear of the unknown. His decency, merely naivete. His sense of morality, prim judgment. How quickly, with a slight twist in perception, do people's strengths become flaws?
What I'm saying is that...
He swallows.
His options are many.
It's no use trying to explain to Alvaro what love is. So I say, You might say the same about Papa when he courted Mother. An ironic look flits across his face.
How's that?
He could have worked on any ship, traveled all over the world. But he settled here with her.
Mother had a big house and hundreds of acres.
He flings his hand toward the window.
You know what this house, the Olsen house, used to be called.
I splash the cutlery in the dishwater impatiently. Did you ever consider that maybe Papa fell in love?
Sure. Maybe. Just remember, you have three brothers. This house isn't yours to inherit.
Walton isn't after this house.
Okay.
He dries his hand on a dish towel and hangs it on a hook.
I'm just saying you should be careful. It's not right for him to keep you on a tether.
I'm not on a tether, I tell him sharply. Anyway, I'd rather be with Walton for 3 months in the summer than any of these local boys all year round. One morning after gathering eggs a few weeks later, I step across the threshold into the house and hear my parents' voices in the shell room, a place they rarely enter. I stand very still in the foyer, cupping the eggs, still warm from the hens, in my hands.
She's no beauty, but she works hard. I think she'd make a fine companion,
Papa is saying. She would, Mother says. But I'm beginning to wonder if he's toying with her. My face tingles as I realize they're talking about me. I lean against the wall, straining to hear.
Who knows? Perhaps he wants to run a farm.
Mother laughs, a dry bark. That one? No.
What does he want with her, then?
Who knows? To fill his idle time, I suspect.
Maybe he really does love her, Katie.
I fear, Mother's voice trails off, that he will not marry her. Papa says,
I fear it too.
My cheeks are aflame, my heart beating in my ears. In my trembling hands, the eggs jostle and shift, and though I try to contain them, they slip between my fingers and drop to the floor, one after the other, splattering smears of yellow and viscous white across the entryway. Mother appears in the doorway, looking stricken. I'll get a rag. She ducks away and comes back. Crouching, she mops the floor around my feet. Both of us are silent. I'm aware of nothing but my own humiliation. The shock of hearing my silent fears put into words. The screen door slams and I watch Papa go past the window, ducking his head on his way to the barn. In September, when Walton is back at school, he writes, I think that night we made the trip to Thomaston was the happiest I ever spent. How could you steer under the circumstances? I believe I was to blame. He is homesick for Cushing. Homesick for me. This was the best summer of my life. A large part of that I owe to you, he writes, signing his letter, with love, Walton. I feel as if a wall of the house has detached from the rest and fallen gently to the ground. I can see a way out, a clear path to the open sea. With Walton and the Carls around all summer, I don't need anyone else. My brothers and I buzz around them, moths to their vivid flame. But after they leave, I am lonely. When Gertrude Gibbons, a girl I never particularly liked at school who has grown into a mildly tolerable adult, invites me to a Wednesday night sewing circle run by a professional seamstress, Catherine Bailey, I reluctantly agree. Gertrude, too, makes her own dresses, and between sessions of the group, we start sewing together in the evenings sometimes, when the chores are done. It's a way to pass the time. On a cool November evening, I take my sewing to Gertrude's house in a sack slung over my shoulder, a 2-mile walk. All day it's been raining. The road is damp, and I have to walk slowly and carefully to avoid muddy puddles.
Finally!
Gertrude exclaims when she answers my knock. Round-faced and ruddy, with an ample bosom that strains the buttons on her dress, she's chewing a molasses cookie. Her large black dog barks and leaps.
Down! Oscar, down! She scolds. Come in, for mercy's sake!
A cat is curled on an upholstered chair.
Shoo, Tom,
Gertrude says, flapping her hands, and the cat reluctantly obliges.
Sit here,
she tells me.
Cookie? Fresh baked.
I'm fine for now, thanks.
That's how you stay so thin, she says. You're abstemious like my sister.
I try, honestly I do, but I don't know how anyone can resist a warm molasses cookie. The house is snug. Embers glow in the fireplace. Gertrude tosses on another log while I get settled. Her parents are away, visiting relatives in Thomaston, she says. Her brother is out with friends. Oscar sprawls in front of the hearth, his eggplant stomach soon rising up and down in contented sleep. We chat about the large yield this season of potatoes and turnips. I tell her about the fox that stole 3 hens out of our coop, and how Al trapped and killed it. She wants to know my famous fried apple cake recipe, and I explain it step by step. How you peel and thinly slice the apples.
fry the slices over a low flame in a heavy black skillet, adding a stream of molasses until the apples are soft in the middle and crispy on the edges, then turn the skillet over onto a platter. I don't tell her that I can no longer turn the skillet on my own and have to ask one of my brothers to do it. The skirt I'm working on is beige cotton, with pleats and pockets. Before I came to Gertrude's, I pressed the fabric with a hot iron, 1 inch all the way around, and now I'm using a slip stitch to hem it. My stitches are small and neat, partly because I have to concentrate so hard to get them right. Gertrude's are sloppy. She is easily distracted, full of gossip she's been waiting to share. Emily Jones had a stillborn baby in the summer, and she still hasn't left the house, poor girl. Earl Standen has a drinking problem. His pregnant wife showed up at Fales with a shiner last week, claiming she walked into a pole. Sarah Stewart married a blacksmith from Rockland she met at a social, but rumor has it she's in love with his brother. "So what do you hear?" she asks. I hold up the fabric and frown, pretending to be vexed by a missed stitch. The more she natters on, the less I want to say. I know she is eager for details about Walton, but I hold them close, not trusting that she won't chew them into cud. She waits patiently, her sewing in her lap. "You are a sphinx, Christina Olson," she says finally. "I'm just a bore," I say. "Nobody tells me anything." "What about that Ramona Carl and that Harlan Woodbury? I hear he's sweet on her." A man named Harlan Woodbury did, in fact, travel up from Boston to visit Ramona this summer in Cushing. But after he left, Ramona made fun of his chubby cheeks and pork pie hat. "Don't know a thing about it," I tell Gertrude. She gives me a sly look. "Well, I heard something you might be able to shed light on." She licks her index finger and rubs the frayed edge of her thread into a point. "I heard," she says, threading her needle, "that a certain young man from Harvard can't make up his mind." A flush moves through me, starting at the top of my head like heat stroke. My fingers tremble. I put down the cloth so Gertrude won't see. "Surely you're aware that a man like that," she says gently as if to a child. She sighs. "Like what?" I ask sharply, and immediately regret engaging her at all. "You know, educated from away." She reaches over and pats my leg. "So just, what's the saying? Don't put all your goods on one ship." "Okay, Gertrude. I know you're private, Christina, and you don't want to talk about this, but I could not in good conscience let the moment pass without telling you what I think." I nod and keep my mouth shut. If I don't speak, she can't answer. Making my way home from Gertrude's house, I am distracted, lost in thought, when my foot sinks into a rut in the road and I tumble forward. As I fall, I try to pivot sideways to protect the parcel I'm carrying containing my half-finished dress, landing with a thud on my right side. I feel a searing jolt of pain in my right leg. Both of my forearms are skinned. As soon as I brush the gravelly dirt off, blood springs to the surface. My leg is twisted under me, my foot splayed in an unnatural direction. The parcel is torn and muddied. It's no use calling for help. No one will hear. If my leg is broken, if I can't get up, it will probably be morning before anyone finds me. How stupid was I to venture out like this on a cold night by myself? And for what? I moan, feeling sorry for myself. People make dumb mistakes all the time, and that's the end of them. A man in Thomaston was found frozen to death last winter in the woods, either because he was disoriented or had a heart attack. People go out in skiffs in cloudy weather, swim in the ocean when there's an undertow, fall asleep with candles burning, go out alone and break a leg in the middle of nowhere on a frigid November night. I reach down to touch my right thigh, the kneecap. I bend my leg and feel a sharp jab. Ah, there. The ankle. Papa urged me to take his walking stick when I left the house, but I refused. I'm so tired of this mutinous body that doesn't move the way it should, or the low, thrumming ache that's never entirely absent, of having to concentrate on my step so I don't fall, of my ever-present scabs and bruises. I'm tired of pretending that I'm the same as everyone else. But to admit what it's really like to live in this skin would mean giving up, and I'm not ready to do that. Your pride will be the end of you, Mother often says. Perhaps she's right. I tuck the parcel into my waistband and struggle to my knees, bunching my skirt beneath me to buffer my skin from the ground. I drag myself toward the side of the road, moving gingerly to avoid putting pressure on my ankle. I squint toward a clump of birches about a dozen feet away, looking for a stick to use as a cane. After pulling myself to my feet, I stagger to the cluster of trees, picking my way over rocks and ruts, and feel around with my hands. Here. Too short, but it'll do. Limping back to the road, I lean heavily on the stick, grimacing through the pain. An hour ago I couldn't wait to leave Gertrude's house, but now going back there is my only option. I hobble slowly down the road. When I see her front porch, I breathe a sigh of relief. I pull myself up the three front steps, leaving a sludgy trail, and pause in front of the door. The lights are off. I pound on the door with the side of my closed fist. No answer. I rap hard on the window beside the door with my knuckles. From deep inside the house I hear footsteps. Through the window I see the glow of a lamp. Then Gertrude's frightened voice on the other side of the door. Who's there? It's me, Christina. The door opens and I lurch inside.
Mercy!
Gertrude flaps her arms like a bird trying to land on a rock.
What happened?
I fell on the road. I think my ankle may be broken.
Oh, dear. You are covered in mud,
she says with dismay. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to bother you. Hot tears spring to my eyes, tears of relief and exhaustion and bitterness, that I can't walk right, that I am back at this house, that damn her, Gertrude may be right. Walton will never marry me. I will be stuck in this place for the rest of my life, sewing with this wretched woman. I turn my face so she doesn't see the tears streaking through the grime. Gertrude sighs and shakes her head.
Stay right there. Let me find a cloth so you don't ruin the rug.
I broke my ankle coming back from Gertrude Gibbons's house, I write to Walton. It was foolish. I never should have been alone on that road in the dark. I am glad to hear that you're on the mend, and dearly hope you'll be more prudent in the future, he writes back. Yours faithfully. I scan the letter several times, trying to hear his voice between the lines, but the words are stiff and formal. No matter how often I read them, they sound like an admonition. I'm apprehensive about seeing Walton for the first time after the long winter apart, but he gives me a warm hug and a kiss on the cheek. I have a present for you, he says, drawing a large shell from the inside pocket of his seersucker jacket and placing it on the table in front of us. I thought you might add it to your collection. The shell is shiny and garishly colored, orange-red, with bulky knobs on top that get smaller toward the edges. I pick it up. It's as smooth and heavy as a glass paperweight. Oh, where did you find this?
I bought it. In a specialty shop in Cambridge, he smiles. From Hawaii, I believe. It's called a cameo shell. At least that's what the card on the shelf said. It'll look nice in the shell room, don't you think?
I nod. Sure. He touches my arm. You don't like it? No, it's interesting. but I'm disappointed that he doesn't know me well enough to understand that this gaudy bauble from a specialty shop doesn't belong in the shell room, filled with discoveries from expeditions. I wish he'd lied and told me he found it on a beach. I set the cameo shell on the mantelpiece in the shell room, but it looks out of place, like an artificial flower in a garden. After a few weeks, I put it in a drawer. As the summer of 1916 progresses, Walton acts exactly as he always has. Solicitous, courtly, quick with a smile and an ironic aside. But I am acutely aware that like a slip of paper in the wind, something in his nature eludes my grasp. Even when I ask direct questions, he is evasive, offering only vague generalities about his life in Boston, his family, his plans for the future. One early July morning, Walton and I are making our way through the high grass to Hawthorne Point to harvest mussels for dinner, when I notice that he's not saying much. He seems uncomfortable, fiddling with his sleeve as he walks. "What is it? Walton, tell me."
"It's just..."
He shakes his head, as if dislodging a thought.
"My parents.
Thinking they know what's best for me." I know his parents live in Malden, near the Carls. As far as I'm aware, they've never come up for a visit. "Did you get a letter?" He bends down, swipes an errant stick from the grass, and snaps it in half with a small, sharp movement.
"Yes. A long, tedious letter. Saying it's time for me to grow up, to take a job in Boston in the summers, and stop frittering away my time up here with the Carls."
He snaps the stick halves in half again before flinging all the tiny pieces onto the ground. "Is this about me?" He shoves his hands in his pockets. His grievance has taken on a theatrical air, as if exaggerated for my benefit.
"It's not personal," he says brusquely. "They claim to be concerned about my future. They don't want me to limit myself."
My heart skitters ahead of my words. What do they mean by that?
"It's absurd," he says. "Keeping up appearances. Harvard, all that. The right job. The right wife."
"Meaning?" I ask in as neutral a tone as I can muster. He shrugs.
"Oh, who knows? They want me to marry someone..."
He lifts forked fingers to convey that he's quoting, "educated," and "from a good family."
"Which means, naturally, a family they've heard of. A Boston family, preferably. A family that will bolster their social standing, because that's the important thing."
I find myself shrinking into silence. Of course Walton's parents don't want their Harvard-educated son marrying a girl who didn't even go to secondary school.
"You're upset," Walton says, patting my arm. "But you shouldn't be. This isn't about you. They don't really know about you."
This shocks me into words. "You've never mentioned me?"
"Of course I've mentioned you," he says quickly. "I just don't think they realize quite how much you mean to me."
"Do they know that we are..." The word sweetheart springs to mind, but I'm afraid it will sound cloying, presumptuous. He shrugs.
"I try not to talk to my parents about much of anything."
"So they don't know that we've been seeing each other for 4 years?"
"I'm not sure what they know, and I don't care," he says dismissively. "Let's put this aside and enjoy the morning, shall we? I'm sorry I brought it up."
I nod, but the conversation has dampened my mood. It's only later, going over it in my head, that I realize he didn't answer my question. The day before Walton and the Carls are to return to Massachusetts, we make a plan to go to the Acorn Grange Hall in Cushing for a dance. Walton shows up earlier than expected with Eloise and Ramona and finds me in the yard behind the house, struggling with a load of laundry. It's wash day, and I can't leave until all the clothes are on the line.
"Go ahead. I'll be along soon," I tell them.
I'm hot and perspiring, still wearing my old frock and apron.
I'll help her finish, he says to the others. We'll catch up with you.
Eloise and Ramona leave the house with Al and Sam in a clamorous gaggle. I watch them as they make their way down the road. Al and Sam, tall and awkward, bending like reeds toward the pretty sisters. Walton helps me wring the damp pieces, his strong hands far more efficient than mine. He hoists the straw basket to his hip, and we make our way to the clothesline. Then, crouching, he takes each piece of damp clothing from the basket, shakes it, and hands it to me, and I pin it to the rope. The intimacy of this ordinary task feels bittersweet. Walton waits on the back stoop while I go inside to change into a clean white blouse and navy skirt. You look nice, he says when I appear. As we stroll toward the Grange Hall, he rummages in his pocket. I hear the familiar crinkle of waxed paper. He pops a butterscotch candy into his mouth. Do you have one for me? I ask.
Of course.
He stops and takes out another, unwraps it, and puts it on my tongue. He rubs my arms.
Autumn in the air already, he muses. Are you cold? Do you need my jacket?
I'm perfect, I say a little stiffly.
I know you're perfect. I was asking if you're chilly.
He smiles, and I can tell he's trying to lighten my mood. I suck on the candy for a moment. You're leaving.
Not for a few days.
Soon.
Too soon, he concedes, lacing his fingers through mine.
For a few minutes we walk along in silence. Then I venture, teachers are needed all over, even in Maine. He squeezes my hand gently but says nothing. Above our heads a riot of birdsong erupts, piercing the quiet. We both look up. The dense tree cover, leaf, lush, gives nothing away. Then suddenly swooping across the road, a dark flurry.
I've never seen so many crows, he remarks.
Actually, they're blackbirds.
Ah, what would I do without you to correct me?
He pulls on my hand playfully, and then, realizing he's yanking me off balance, tucks his arm around my waist.
Such a clever girl, he murmurs in my ear.
Then he slows and stops in the road. I'm not sure what he's doing. What is it? He puts a finger to his lips and tugs me gently down the embankment, into a copse of blue-black spruce. In the shadows, he cups my warm face in his cool hands.
You are truly something, Christina.
I look into his pale eyes, trying to decipher what he's saying. He gazes back implacably. I can't tell if you're sad to be leaving, I say, a petulant tone creeping into my voice.
Of course I am. But admit it, you'll be a bit relieved. Finally, summer's over. I have my life back.
I shake my head. He shakes his head, mimicking me.
No?
No. I... He kisses me on the mouth, gathers me closer, kisses my bony shoulder, the hollow of my neck. He runs his hand down my bodice, hesitates for a moment, then continues all the way to the folds of my skirt. I am dizzy with surprise. He pushes me back against the bark of a tree. I feel its knots pressing into my back as he leans into me, running a hand down my side, another under my blouse, up the slight curve of my breast. His mouth on mine jams my head awkwardly against the trunk. An uncomfortable, and yet not altogether unpleasant experience. The butterscotch clicks in my mouth. I'd better spit this out, or I might choke, I say.
He laughs. Me too.
I don't care that it's unladylike. I spit it on the grass. Now his hand is between my legs, lost in the fabric. I feel him cup me there in a proprietary way, and I push my hips toward him, feeling his hardness between us. My skin is alive, every nerve ending pulsing. His breathing ragged, insistent. This is what I want. This passion. This certainty. This clear sign of his desire. Right now I would do anything. Anything he asks. And then, a sound on the road. Walton jerks his head up.
alert as a bird dog.
What is that?
He breathes. I cock my head, feel a low rumbling in my soles. An automobile, I think. The sky is dark now. I can barely see his face. He pulls back, then sways into me, clutching my shoulders.
Oh, Christina, he murmurs. You make me want you.
The darkness emboldens me. I'm yours. Still holding my shoulders, he rests his head on my breastbone like a nudging sheep. When he sighs, I feel his warm breath on my chest.
I know.
Then he looks up into my eyes with a startling intensity.
We must be together.
Beyond, he waves an arm, indicating the trees, the road, the sky, all this. My heart leaps. Oh, Walton, do you mean it?
I do. I promise.
Though everything in my nature fights against it, I'm determined to find out what he means. Swallowing hard, I ask, what do you promise?
That we'll be together.
There are things I need to resolve. You must come to Boston and meet my parents.
But I promise you, Christina, yes.
Blue-black spruce, shushing overhead. Gravelly dirt under my thin-soled shoes. The smell of pine, a Necco wafer of moon in the sky. Some sense memories fade as soon as they're past. Others are etched in your mind for the rest of your life. This, I already know, is one of those. When we get to the Grange Hall, Ramona and Eloise are chatting and dancing with whatever stray boys they can round up, gaily pulling them out of chairs. The makeshift band, fiddle and piano and standing bass, is composed of some of the boys I grew up with. Billy Grover and Michael Verzolino and Walter Brown. They play raucous, sloppy versions of The Maple Leaf Rag and It's a Long Way to Tipperary. Walton croons in my ear.
Leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
When they start to play Danny Boy, I listen to the words as if I've never heard them before, as if they were written just for me. The summer's gone and all the roses dying. Tis you. Tis you must go and I must bide. Tis I'll be here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh Danny Boy, I love you so. We dance nose to nose, Walton's hand low on my waist, a tacit reminder of our moment in the woods.
I'll miss this, he says. I'll miss you.
My voice chokes in my throat. I don't trust myself to speak. After the last song, we make our way home on the dark road with the others. My legs are tired, but melancholy makes me even slower. Like a dog on a leash being pulled where it doesn't want to go. Walton puts his arm around me and we fall back, away from the others. At the turnoff for the Carls, we linger by the gate. I lean my head on his shoulder.
I wish I could reach up and grab a faraway star and put it on your finger, Walton says.
Running a finger over my lips, he bends down to kiss me. I feel in his kiss the weight of his promise. 10 days later, I receive a letter postmarked Massachusetts.
Remember a week ago tonight? I shall remember it until I see you again, he writes. What promises I make, I keep.
December is as gray as my mood. I haven't received a letter from Walton since September. Though it's cold, there's little snow. A cat has been hiding under the house. A butterscotch tiger-striped Maine coon with enormous ginger eyes. I tempt it out with a bowl of milk. Shivering, it laps the milk hungrily, and when the bowl is empty, I lift it onto my lap. A female. Her skin is loose around her bones. It's like cradling a bag of hollow pipes. She licks my chin with a sea urchin tongue and settles on my lap with a purr. I name her Lolly.
She's the only bright spot of my entire month. For Christmas, I give my brothers plaid shirts I've sewn out of flannel while they were working outside. Mother knits socks and hats. Papa makes no pretense of giving presents. He says the roof over our heads is present enough. Sam gives me a baking tray. Fred puts a ribbon on a new straw broom. Al carves a set of wooden spoons. Walton sends a thick, cream-colored card, foil-stamped with a green wreath and a red bow, addressed to the Olsen family. Sending you warm wishes in this cold season. Happy Christmas and God bless. He signs it, Walton Hall. Instead of displaying his card, as I've done in past years, I take it upstairs to my room. I take the stack of his letters from the shelf where I keep them, untie the pale pink ribbon, and sit on my bed, opening the letters and reading each one. All roads lead back to Cushing for me. What promises I make, I keep. With love. I hold the Christmas card between my hands so tightly that it rips a little. Slowly I tear it down the middle. Then rip the pieces again and again, until they're as small as butterscotch candies, as 2-cent stamps, as faraway stars in the sky. I write to Walton after the holidays, wishing him a happy 1917, telling him about the presents I received from my brothers and the flannel shirts I sewed. I describe the suckling pig we roasted in a pit Al built in the yard, the blueberry compote and fried apple cake, the chicken stew with squash dumplings, and the drink Sam concocts on New Year's Eve. Rum, molasses, and cloves in a mug with boiling water, blended with a cinnamon stick. Whaler's toddy, it's called. I strive to convey the flavor of our humble rituals, the camaraderie and clamor of a house filled with boys, a feeling of well-being and holiday cheer that isn't so much exaggerated in the telling as enhanced. I do my best to avoid a plaintive undertow. I don't understand. Why haven't you written? Days pass. Weeks. Months. I thought I was used to waiting. This is a new kind of hell. My soul feels coated with tar. I berate myself for the letter I sent, filled with mindless chatter about our simple rituals. What I have to share is paltry, insignificant, domestic. And yet it's all I have to give. As winter turns to spring, I slog to the post office, zigzagging through the snow and slush. Bills, flyers, the Saturday evening post. "Nothing for you today, Christina," Bertha Dorset says, her prim voice threaded with pity. I want to lunge across the counter and throttle her until her face purples and she gasps for breath. But I take the mail and smile. Even when the snow melts and the crocuses bloom, I am cold, always cold, no matter how many blankets I pile on my bed. In the middle of the night, I listen to the wind screaming through the gaps in the wall. I remember a story I read once about a woman who goes mad trapped inside her house and comes to believe that she lives behind the wallpaper. I am beginning to wonder if I will stay in this house forever. Creeping up and down the stairs like the woman in that story. It is a warm morning in May when I see Ramona out the kitchen window, striding toward the house across the grass, head down, shoulders squared. I've thought about this day all winter. I sink into my old chair beside the red geraniums. Lolly springs onto my lap and I stroke her back. Ordinarily I would get up, put a kettle on for tea, stand in the doorway to welcome her, but I can't rally the energy to cover the conversation that I know is coming with the rituals of a friendly visit. Ramona isn't surprised to find me in the kitchen. "Hello, Christina. Mind if I come in?" Her smile is wobbly. Stepping across the threshold into the gloom, she squints. "So good to see you." I muster a smile in response. "You too. Did I catch you in the middle of something?" "Just the usual." "You look well." "I know I don't." I'm wearing an old apron over a plain checked dress. I wasn't expecting company. I start to untie the back of the apron.
Oh, please don't change, she says, adding quickly. It's just me.
I'm done with the lunch dishes. About to take it off anyway. She watches me wrestle with the tie in the back. I can tell she wants to help, but knows I wouldn't like it. For a moment, she hesitates in the middle of the floor. She's clutching a paper bag and wearing a style of dress I haven't seen before. Yellow and white, checkerboard patterned, with full white sleeves and three tortoiseshell buttons. A drapey white collar. And a wide waistband. Pale stockings and white leather shoes. Her hair is pulled back in a bun with a yellow ribbon. That's a nice dress, I say. Though her outfit makes me think she must be stopping through on her way to somewhere more exciting.
Oh, thank you. It's summery, don't you think?
I guess. As if suddenly remembering, she says,
I brought you something.
Mama had a crate sent from Florida. She takes three large oranges out of her bag and sets them on the table.
I'd love to get down to Florida one of these days. I can just see myself lying on a beach on a towel with a big straw hat. Wouldn't that be nice?
Maybe so.
How about we go together, in the winter sometime when it's so dang cold?
I shrug.
I'm not keen on burning in the sun.
I forget about your Swedish skin, she says.
Why don't I peel us an orange and I can dream about Florida and you enjoy a healthy treat?
Well, I just ate lunch, I begin. Then relent.
All right.
She digs into an orange with her thumbs and peels back the thick, cratered crust, carefully picks off the white veins. Pulling it apart, she hands me a slice.
Cheers!
The orange is so sweet, so juicy, that I almost forget how nervous I am. When we've polished it off, Ramona pulls Al's rocker toward the table and sits down.
I love this old rocker, she says. So lived in.
She rubs the arms where the black paint has worn through to wood. It's only now, with her hands draped over the arms of the rocker, that I notice a sparkle on her finger, a ring.
My goodness, is that?
She blushes deeply, then leans forward and thrusts her splayed fingers toward me.
Yes, can you believe it? Engaged. I wondered when you'd notice.
The false cheer in her voice is evidence of how awkward this is for both of us.
I would have written to let you know, but it happened only a few weeks ago.
The ring, with a sizable central diamond, encircled by a pattern of tiny diamond chips, is more ornate than any I've ever seen. I tell her honestly, it's beautiful. From Harland, I assume? She laughs.
Of course, Harland.
It got quite serious quite suddenly. We plan to marry in the fall. Just a small family wedding.
There's lots to do, goodness. But I'm so glad to be back here now. And to see you.
Well, I think of portly Harland in his funny short-brimmed hat. Congratulations.
Thank you. It means the world to have your blessing.
Spying Lolly sidling through the doorway, she cries,
Oh, what a pretty cat! So big!
She's a Maine Coon. They're little tigers.
Here, kitty.
She clucks her tongue and snaps her fingers. Lolly freezes, looks back and forth between us. She won't come, I say. She's stubborn and shy. Like me. As if to demonstrate, the cat streaks across the floor and leaps onto my lap. Ramona smiles.
You're not shy. You just like who you like.
That cat's the same way. Lolly arches into my hand, insisting that I stroke her. And for a few moments her steady purring is the only sound in the room. A faint citrus scent lingers in the air. Finally Ramona sighs.
I have been fretting about how to bring this up. Walton, I don't...
She shakes her head, twists one of the large buttons on her dress.
He's a dear, I adore him, but he can be so exasperating.
I can't follow what she's saying. Walton is a dear. She adores him. He stopped writing, I say.
I know, he told me.
I grip Lolly's back so hard that she meows and sinks a claw into my palm, then squirms out of my lap. A bead of blood springs to the surface of my hand. I wipe it on my skirt, leaving a pink smear.
It was abominable of him. I kept telling him so, and, well, cruel.
Though I knew this moment was coming, not a single fiber of my being wants to be having this conversation.
Ramona, let me bumble through this. Horrible as it is, I have to. Walton loves you, loved you, I suppose. Oh, Christina.
She sighs.
Every word out of my mouth is as painful for me to say as it must be for you to hear, and I don't want to do this, but...
She stops, then blurts.
Walton is engaged to be married.
Walton is engaged to be married. Am I missing something? Engaged to be married to me? I look at her blankly. Walton is engaged to be married. To someone else. In all the ways I've thought about his silence, considered its sources, this possibility never occurred to me. But why not? It makes the most logical sense. He stopped writing abruptly.
Of course, he met someone else.
I feel as if I am emptied out, filled with thick, heavy air. I can't think or see. It fills me to my eyes. I try to remember what Walton looks like. A straw boater with a black grosgrain ribbon. A linen jacket. Soft, girlish hands. But I can't envision his face.
Christina, are you all right?
Ramona's face is stretched into a ghastly expression. I look into her eyes. It's as if I'm watching her through a scrim.
Why?
A tiny word. One syllable, not even a question. She sighs.
I've asked myself a million times, and Walton too. I've begged him for an answer that makes sense. I don't even know if he knows, except...
Her voice trails off.
Except...
She twists in her chair.
The distance.
And his parents.
His parents. He told you, he said, that they disapproved.
He didn't say that.
He didn't?
Leaning back in the chair, I close my eyes. Maybe he did.
His mother is an awful woman, a striver. She wants, a certain kind of life for her golden boy. And she kept bringing around the daughter of a friend, a girl at Smith, and I just think after a while he thought, what's the use? I can't fight it anymore. The easiest thing is to give in.
The easiest thing, I echo.
I suppose she's not a bad sort, really. She's all right,
Ramona shrugs.
Though, of course, I never said that to him. I only told him how vexed I was, how disappointed, on your behalf.
By the way she's telling me this, I can see that she has spent time with this woman. That they have all been out together.
What is her name?
Marilyn. Marilyn Wales. I contemplate this for a moment. A real person. With a name. He never even wrote to explain.
I know. It makes me so angry. We argued about it. I told him it was unconscionably rude. He said he couldn't do it. He begged me to write to you myself, to tell you, and honestly, I refused. I feel as if I'm being whipped. Every word a lash. You knew I was waiting,
I say slowly, my voice rising.
And you wouldn't put me out of my misery?
Christina, Mother calls from upstairs.
Everything all right?
I look steadily at Ramona, and she looks back, her eyes filling with tears.
I am so sorry,
she says.
Everything is fine, Mother,
I call back.
Who's there?
Ramona Carl. My mother is silent.
He didn't deserve you,
Ramona whispers. I shake my head.
Yes, he's smart, and he can be charming. But quite honestly, he is a weak man. I see that now.
Stop, I say. Just stop.
Leaning forward in the rocker, Ramona says,
Christina, listen to me. There will be other fish in the sea.
No, there won't.
There will. We'll find you a great catch.
I have hung up my rod, I say. This seems to break the tension. Ramona smiles. It was hard for her to be this serious. She isn't constitutionally cut out for it.
For now, there'll be more expeditions.
Not in this leaky boat. She laughs a little. You are as stubborn as a Maine coon, Christina Olson. Maybe so, I tell her. Maybe I am. When I go to bed, I never want to get up. There's an ache deep in my bones that won't go away. I jolt awake in the night, sobbing in pain. Nothing will ever get better. It will only get worse. I pull the blue wool blanket Papa made tighter around me and finally drift to sleep. When I wake several hours later in the astringent light of morning, I bury my face in my pillow. Al comes into my room. I can hear him, see him, though my eyes are shut and I pretend to be asleep.
Christina,
he says softly. I don't answer.
I found some bread and jam for breakfast. Sam and Fred are in the barn. I'll bring eggs to Mother and Papa when chores are finished.
I sigh. Tacit acknowledgement that I hear him. Behind my eyelashes, I see him look down, hands on hips.
Are you sick?
Yes.
Do you need a doctor?
No. I open my eyes, but I can't rouse myself to an expression. He looks back at me steadily. I don't remember ever holding his gaze like this.
I would like to kill him, he says. I really would.
My bed feels like a shallow grave. I take the stack of letters from Walton, tied with their pale pink ribbon, and place them in a box. Part of me wants to set them on fire and watch them burn, but I can't bring myself to do it. At the top of the first flight of stairs is a small closet door on the side wall. When no one is around, I slide the box into a dark corner of the closet. I don't want to see his letters. I just want proof that they exist. In town, nobody says a word about it, at least not to me. But I see the pity in their eyes. I hear the whispers.
She was abandoned, you know.
Their sympathy fills me with a shame so deep that I can understand why someone might sail off to a distant land, never to return to where he's from. Getting ready for a late afternoon sail with my brothers on a warm June day, I tuck the shell Walton gave me into my pocket. On the sloop, I stroke it with my fingers, probing its rough crevices and silky exterior. It's the perfect weight and shape to nestle in my palm. Toward the end of the trip, as the sun dips in the sky, I move to the back of the small sailboat and sit alone, peering down at the scalloped water. How easy it would be to slip over the side and sink to the bottom of the ocean. Blackness. Only blackness. And merciful unconsciousness. I taste the tears running down my face. Salty sweet in my mouth. Before long, no doubt, my brothers will marry. My parents will weaken and die. And I will be alone in the house on the hill, with nothing to look forward to but the slow change of seasons, my own aging and infirmity, the house turning to dust. Walton and I sat together at the back of the boat just like this.
I adore you,
he whispered in my ear. How devoted he was. He couldn't get enough of me. Loved only me. Only me. His solid shoulder against mine, his long finger pointing toward the sky, the constellations, all the names I learned so eagerly. Orion the Hunter, Cassiopeia, Hercules, Pegasus. I look up now at the darkening sky, as solid as slate. The stars are washed away, present only in memory. Closing my eyes, I lean over the side, the salt spray on my face mingling with tears. I weigh the shell in my palm. This cameo shell that has no place with the others. A store-bought trinket with no history, no story. I knew, deep down, when he gave it to me, that he didn't understand anything about me. Why didn't I recognize